This episode contains strong content which may relate to vivid language, graphic descriptions, or other material that may upset you. Please listen at your own discretion. America, a great nation. A nation of migrants, locals, and natives. A nation where we celebrate freedom, or so we think. Yet, with all of the cultural heritage present in America, what is cultural heritage? What does it actually mean to all the members of this vast nation? Today on Disruptive Adventism, we talk about America, immigration, heritage, and everything in between, with three up-and-coming scholars, Lisbeth Santana, Sydney Johnson, and June Kuch. We commence with some definitions and what does heritage means to them. So let's start with Lisbeth and her background.
So my dad is an indigenous Coca, so I am very aware of that, just knowing that I do have an indigenous background, very close to just a generation apart from me. Obviously, I'm not super submerged into it just because I am from the United States, basically just being disconnected from that space. But we always traveled back to Mexico. So that allowed me to know more about my culture. But I don't really share that with a lot of people because I feel like I'm not ready to express what that means, being a first generation Latinx student, right? More so just because I was raised more with the idea that I was Mexican American or Chicana. Once I'm at the university, I figured that out. So for me, it's just the idea of representing an idea that not everyone has the same access as I do to different sources. So I guess the immediate answer is just that I feel very blessed just because in my family, my grandparents, specifically on my mom's side, wanted to be a teacher, and also my dad, a history teacher. But they never had the access to these resources in Mexico specifically because they were like either the oldest in their family or the economic resources weren't there. So they immediately had to cross to from Mexico to the U.S. and work. So I think that idea of representing what my family wanted to do in regards to education has allowed me to push forward. Even right now, like in my family, I'm the only one in the university. Even if my brother and my sister were born here, they didn't have the same opportunities I did. So I think they had to basically give up their dreams to have me access these other resources just because they saw that I had this passion for school. And it was something that came naturally. But just with the idea of you mentioning people crossing the border and losing their education titles, I mean, it's really unfortunate because I've known people that were professors in Mexico and then they came back to into the U.S. and then they were cleaning houses, for example. Because that's what my family does. And for me to be able to cross into Mexico, I'm still a grad student with a professional title. So for me, I always have to be aware of who I am in that space because I do have some type of authority and I have to make sure that I don't overstep in certain spaces specifically.
Having gained a little bit of the Latin American perspective, let's now move to the context of Asians in the United States. So we have June for that. June Kuch is going to start us off with more heritage from the Asian perspective.
Well, Asian America is a very heterogeneous group. We come from Asia is a continent. So, I mean, you can't determine a culture for a whole continent. We have South Asians, West Asians, Southeast Asians, East Asians, a lot. But I'm Southeast Asian. Specifically, I think about heritage in a very different way than other folks, I think, that have been here in the United States longer, that are fifth gen Chinese American, whose families came to be gold miners. My family are refugees. My parents came as refugees in the 80s as a result of U.S. intervention in Cambodia. That bombs, carpet bombing on the border of Cambodia and Vietnam resulted in political instability in Cambodia that resulted in the rise of the Khmer Rouge, which also produced another political instability and genocide in Cambodia, which my parents fled, and I had family members who passed away in the genocide. I think for us in the Southeast Asian community, there's a fundamental, the United States has an ethical responsibility to answer the question of your involvement in Southeast Asia has produced us to be in the United States. Insofar, your war, French colonization, U.S. imperialism, U.S. intervention has created the conditions for us to now re-enter or enter the United States, face anti-Black violence similar to Black communities because we were placed during, we were during the Carter administration after the Refugee Act was passed in 1980. He strategically had a plan to separate refugee communities, Southeast Asian refugee communities throughout the United States. So they were placed in small communities like in the Midwest, the South, California, but then communities would obviously travel to larger communities, blah, blah, blah. But he was very strategic in that he thought that if we were placed in only singular families were placed in majority white communities that we would assimilate faster. This was false, clearly. Communities suffered a different discursive form of how anti-Black racism functions in that Black criminality, the way in which the drug war was going on in the 80s became extended to Southeast Asian communities. I think this is, I mean, going back to the question, I feel like it's about positive spin on heritage. For me, thinking about refugee life or refugee, like scholars say, like refugee epistemologies or ontologies, I think it's about like what responsibility do nations have to care for its people?
And such a question moves us from the Asian refugee perspective to the local individual perspective of African Americans who have lived in this country and who can ask that question. What is the responsibility that America has with its own people? And has America provided a place of safety for Black Americans in the United States? For that, we explore a little bit more of heritage from the African American perspective from Sydney Johnson.
So the first thing that I like to say is that the Black American community or African American, I prefer Black American because, like you said, the separation from the 54 nations in Africa, I don't have the privilege of knowing which one specifically my family descended from. I know generally West Africa, but that's just a guess. I grew up in Kentucky, Louisville, Kentucky, to be exact, but I grew up in a largely white area, but just because I might have experienced physical safety doesn't mean that I didn't experience emotional violence, mental violence. Being one of the only people of color, only Black women in most of my educational spaces is inherently a violent space when you're not around people who look like you, can level with you on a cultural level. You never have teachers who look like you. That is violence, right? When you're not hearing or being taught narratives that include stories about you, when you don't have teachers who can communicate to you culturally and level with you on certain aspects, that is a violent narrative, right? So I think that's something that connects all of our three different views. This idea of what Dr. Salamisha Tillett, a professor at Rutgers Newark, where I am a student, in her book, Sites of Slavery, this idea of civic estrangement that she has expounded upon, this idea that certain groups in America are further marginalized and distanced from the symbols and the narratives that are attendant to this idea of America and the United States, right? So as a Black person, as an Asian person, a Latinx person, because of the ways that white supremacy, patriarchal systems operate in America, we don't have the privilege of being included in these various stories that are so important to this idea of American nationalism, right? So that in and of itself is a system of violence, right? We can't see ourselves represented in these larger stories that characterize everything that is the substance of the ideology of this country. Right? So we're further distanced from what everyone associates with what makes America such a great place to be.
So far we've gained some perspectives from the heritage question. When we come back, we talk more about deportation, immigration, colonization, and more. Stay tuned for Disruptive Adventism. We'll be right back. Today on Disruptive Adventism, we're talking about reimagining America, a conversation on culture, heritage, colonization, immigration, and more. So thank you for listening to this podcast. And now we're going to continue on the colonization area. Is it ever positive to import any behavior from our culture to another culture, let it that we consider it less civilized or more civilized, and impose that behavior. That's what colonization is, imposing a behavior from our culture onto another culture. So is it ever positive? Let's find out. Lisbeth starts us off.
No, I would say no. But I think for me specifically, just speaking Spanish is a constant reminder of what happened, you know, to all of this side of the world specifically, right? And I'm not going to go into details just because I feel like most of us are very familiar with what happened. But I think just the idea that even I study Spanish, and within my own department, I struggle with the idea of what's the right way of speaking Spanish, and the idea of colonizing us again through education. And it's a constant battle to be yourself coming from an immigrant community background and being inflicted with all of these ideas that there's a certain type of profile that should fit the education criteria. And unfortunately, I don't fit all those criteria because I do speak Spanglish specifically, Spanish and English. Even if I learn Portuguese and French, it does not matter because I don't fall into the white idea of like what's part of power. So if I do have some type of agency, it's never going to meet the criteria of being full-on American or from the U.S. just because I have this immigrant background. So if myself being born in the U.S., I'm facing all of these pushbacks from my own nation, then what am I going to expect for people who are immigrants? Or even if they came here legally or if they have all their documents in order, what am I going to expect for their experiences to be like? You know, there's always going to be this idea of not always belonging in every space. So I guess with your question, is it ever positive? I mean, the only way, if I'm going to be like naive about it, I would say at least we could communicate through Spanish, or like when we hear Spanish music or something in our cultural background, you feel it. But then other than that, there's nothing else that I would see that might be positive. I think the idea of saving them from themselves is problematic because in that action, we're trying to say that our way of doing things or idealizing things is the correct way. So from the beginning, that's wrong because we're telling someone or a group of people that their way of living is wrong based on our own standards. And that falls into a lot of different things, you know, just the idea of migrating. I mean, I come from a Mexican background. The idea of the man as the one controlling the home and then the woman staying in the house, right? Like the idea of a sumisa is still inflicted on this side of the border. In my family, the same thing. So it's something that you always struggle with. Like, for example, with my own dad, the idea of letting me go to the university on my own as a woman without being married, right? Getting out of the house without being married. So you struggle with those dynamics within your own home space. So I don't have to go out and observe the entire world, but just within my own cycle or like my own familiar space, I still struggle with those ideas. Or just being a woman doing field work at a border town, why are you putting yourself in danger when you don't have a man next to you? So those things are always something that I have to always battle through in that idea. But I don't think, I understand that the US has some type of progressive ideas in regards to women, but we're still not where we're supposed to be at.
So that is one aspect of colonization, teaching a language, maintaining that language, or depriving other people of using their own languages. But what about gender roles? As Lisbeth touched upon, June continues the conversation on the vein of gender colonization.
Okay, I think in the context though that colonization is the root cause, I think that needs to be said, of patriarchal practices that exists today, anti-queer practices, the construction of gender is constructed through the way in which Europe has colonized other places, such as Southeast Asia, that they have ostracized how queer folks, I'll give the example in Cambodia or in Southeast Asia, is that queer folks are spiritual, non-Catholic, blah, 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 non-Roman, dominational, blah, blah, blah. But they become demonized. Our indigenous practices become seen as savage, inhuman, and thus then Western understandings of gender becomes imposed on our communities. And then we try to perform these patriarchal things to be the new colonizer, to be the white man, that we want to be, perform patriarchal acts, violence against women, violence against queer folks, in the sense that we want to act like the colonizer. We want to show that we, yes, we can be like you. We can be like you. We can hate women. We can beat women. You know, that gets us a slice in the pie. You hate women. You do shit to women, and so you're doing well, so we can do that shit too. And if you want us to have these violent practices instead of our practices, we can do that shit too. You know, my understanding is, like, if we want to decolonize or really produce practices of equality, that I feel like that's not possible within the structure of the global sphere that we live in. You know what I mean? People talk about, look at how in this Asian country, y'all do fucked up shit to queer folks. But in the U.S., we're doing great. That positioning positions, one, the United States as an exception. Like, we don't do fucked up shit. That's false. That one, using one minority group to justify another violence on another minority group is not okay. This is not time for cost-benefit analysis of who we're going to save on the boat. This isn't the Titanic. Jack is not gonna sink in the bottom. You know what I mean? Like, we're trying to, this is, for, if we're talking about liberation, wouldn't it be talking about a collective change? I think this goes back to the talk that Robin Kelly had earlier today. It's about, like, decolonization requires a fundamental global change that is on the planet, that it is impossible to decolonize one country, that rather we must collectively work. You know what I mean? Like, I can't, you know, I think a good example of this, Sydney might be better at thinking about or talking about the Black experience than I am, but Haiti is a great example of how decolonization was impossible, in that they got that island back, they took that shit back, but you know who didn't give a fuck? White people, the colonizer. France put on debt. Haiti had debt to the United States, all this other shit. They had the ability to be self-determined, but we still exist within a global capitalist system that forecloses possibilities of decolonization. So, I don't know. I'm gonna just pass that mic.
Yeah, so kind of building on what my colleague June said, I'm not an African scholar in the least, West African scholar, but I do have some knowledge. So thinking about when, in the 50s and 60s, various African nations decided to fight for their independence, and they were given it, right? They were indebted to the European nations who colonized them, right? So the structural adjustment programs, right? These programs that were created to help these nations that were fighting for their independence become more economically sound, have more social programs. There were certain stipulations and hoops that these nations had to jump through in order to prove that they were ready by European standards to be rulers in their own right. But all of these stipulations were still guided and overseen by who? The same people who colonized them in the first place, just given different titles, right? So once again, just as in the case of Haiti, they were still indebted to these nations and still are. So this idea of help is always costumed and veiled, right? This idea of assistance,
development.
Right? Development, right?
Development into what?
Into what, right? Trying to make you shape yourself after these countries, but you're not giving the same resources, the same footing to be able to do that, right? So you inherently fail. So this idea that we can impose these xenophobic ideas of what is right, what is beneficial for these nations that are inherently different culturally, it's like historically amnesiac. It makes no sense. You're forgetting where, how the position that you put these nations in the first place. It makes no sense. So colonization in no regard is beneficial to anyone but the colonizer. There is no help, no assistance in colonization at all. It is inherently wrong.
And it's still going on.
And it's still going on every single day in the language that we use, in the foods that we eat, in the clothes that we wear, in the spaces that we're in right now. The land that we are literally recording this podcast on is colonized land. There's nothing beneficial about it. Mic drop.
A figurative drop the mic, not a literal one. Otherwise, you will not be hearing this podcast. But right there, we heard about three different perspectives on colonization: linguistic, gender roles, and also financial, economic colonization, and the effects of it in different countries. And you may be willing to go and look up on Google or your favorite library, yes, they do still exist, topics about colonization, books, articles that help you understand that imposing our culture upon other people is never helpful. But that can also go into the religious vein. When we get back, we talk about imagining America in the future, and also about what would Jesus do? Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. We are back with the last segment of Disruptive Adventism. Thank you for listening. And now we turn to reimagining America. The final topic is, how do you see America in the future? Let us get started with Sydney.
So going back to what my colleague said, we had this wonderful plenary talk in the Imagining America conference today. Amazing scholar, Robin D.G. Kelly, he said that reimagining America to its fullest, most inclusive sense will never be possible until we burn the whole place down, honestly, because these structures that have created this nation they're not pliable enough to allow for equality amongst all. But for me, like I kind of stated before, this idea of equity and inclusion in storytelling. We need people who look like us telling our stories. We can no longer have old white men crafting these narratives about who, what, and when America was and should be, right? We need Latinx, Asian, Black, Purple, Green, Blue, and Brown, queer, trans, Two-Spirit, Native, Indigenous. Everyone needs to have their voices represented because all of us created the fabric. We are the weavers of this nation, right? Like I said, it was literally built on our backs. Labor, right?
And war.
And war and labor and violence were extracted from us to build all of this up, right? It wasn't always pretty. It was not harmonious, but the variety and the myriad ways that these stories have been told, they need to be told in their fullest sense by the people who have the greatest stakes in that, right? I think my reimagining of America is having people of various backgrounds being allowed to collaboratively work together to craft inclusive narratives about this nation in its past and its truest sense.
A beautiful vision of America, where every narrative is counted. A very important part for a new culture and the future of this country and great nation. But let's continue with June's imagination of America and the changes that need to be seen.
I don't know. I feel like I don't imagine America. I imagine a lack of America in my imagined America. I imagine a Turtle Island. Indigenous land given back, indigenous people having the self-determination. You know, as Frantz Fanon writes, decolonization is a violent process. And for me, as a refugee or children of refugees, I'm not indigenous to this land, but I think we all need to be able to call in our own stakes in other people's struggles. You know what I mean? So the way I envision, I imagine my vision for America is, one, a place with no prisons. A place with no borders, a place with ICE doesn't exist, a place where indigenous people have self-determination of their own place, and that land is not property, or we don't have ownership of land, but everyone has relation. We're all in relationship with one another. How do we care and create community and hold space to truly be, I don't know, like, together? Like, I think that's so, like, egalitarian or whatever, but, like, but I think we need to think about relationality between communities, and I think holding space for that is how I imagine America. I imagine a space where we can have transformative practices of accountability, which community, which already has happened, could come in to deal with things like domestic violence, sexual assault, things like that, that we don't need cops in our communities to tell us what to do. How we don't need the state to imprison people to tell us what to do and what is good for our healing. Rather, healing should be centered with a survivor lens.
And last but not least on this question, we have Lisbeth Santana and her imagination of America.
I feel that the U.S., and I'm going to say I love my country in the sense that I know that a lot of us that are pushing back or resisting all these violent like actions being taken, like historically, right? Because my grandparents were braceros, and I feel that sometimes that's one of the silences in my family, talking about them being in the U.S., working here legally, and then undocumented in the case of one of my grandparents. But the idea that they were forced to leave their own country to work in the U.S. because the U.S. needed them at that point. But then we're discarded because we're not bodies that are desired, because we're bodies of color, bodies that don't match the ideal prototype of the ideal immigrant, right? Because we don't come from a rich background, and all we could really give this country is labor, right? So something that I feel, if I'm imagining some type of America, actually something that June mentioned yesterday was the idea of not like safe spaces, but brave spaces, and where people like ourselves could actually say, this is wrong and we're gonna change it. Even if it's gonna be taxing on us and emotionally draining, because that's what we're doing right now. I feel like we're being drained of our energy. We have a lot of things going on in our own backgrounds, and we still have to present ourselves and be scholars and activists and community work people, right? And I feel like that's something that the US thrives on. But at the end of the day, we're still trying to push a certain agenda that no one wants to call out because X and Y reasons. Yeah. So there's no ideal America. And if we do want to, we need to like abolish, right? Or eliminate, burn it down, right? Because I always hear about one of my colleagues, Marlene, she always talks about burning down the university. So I always wonder, you mean physically or just metaphorically? But she means both, right? So at the beginning, I was scared of that idea. But then at the end of the day, I understand where she's coming from.
So the question now stands, how do you imagine America? What would you like to see? But before we leave, and as a final word, I'll leave you what my three guests said about what would Jesus do if he were reimagining America, and not only America, but the whole world.
I gotta think about this question, but I think my perspective on this question might be different than people on the panel, I mean, on the podcast, in the sense, I didn't grow up in the church. My family didn't grow up in the church. I wouldn't say I'm Buddhist, but rather culturally Buddhist, if that makes sense. But I feel like understanding Christ, I think the spirit, understanding spirituality, is critical to liberation. You know, Robin Kelly's book, Freedom Dreams, the spirit and the body is essential to possibilities of futures. When I think about Christ, I think about how Christ is weaponized to foreclose those possibilities. But I think about Christ has the ability to think about movements and power in a way that is very generative for those who grew up in that faith. And I think particularly for those who practice, I think I've heard this term before in conferences and talking to other people or people that are studying theology, liberation theology, you know, that thinking about the church as sanctuary or refuge, I think is very generative. And that liberation theology, I think from my understanding of it, people view Christ as non-white, as a person of color, specifically from those who I've talked to that practice liberation theology, say that Christ is black, that this comes out of, you know, the civil rights movement, that Christ would be supporting people of color, would be helping those at the border, I think, would be stopping deportations, I feel like. And I think Christ would be hanging out with the fags, no offense. Like, I'm gonna say that real straight up. Like, yeah, he'll be your best friend. Like, all religions, if you want to practice it in a liberatory way, you shouldn't be beating your wife. You shouldn't be harming communities of color, queer folks. Rather, it should be about an internal journey for you to understand your positionality and larger structures in order to practice and move through the world to not hurt others, but also hold space and possibility for those people so they can find safety, if that makes sense.
Well, I am a believer, and I grew up in a Catholic home, and I did have like Christian nannies. So I feel like I've always been exposed to the idea of giving a lot of yourself for something that you believe in, right? So for me, that's why I feel like I'm always passionate about what I do, because I know at the end of the day, even if I'm struggling, like, and I don't even know where to like get the energy to continue, like, I know there's a purpose behind this. So even if it might seem artificial to someone, right, who might not be a believer or understand, but just for me, the idea that there's something better that's going to come in, right? There's going to be some type of hope. That's what really helps me do the work that I do, specifically with immigrants or migrants who are deported. And I see it a lot in Tijuana because that's where I work. There's a lot of people that intend to do good, but at the end of the day, they try to exploit the migrant or the deportee. So at the end of the day, even if we're trying to do good, we reproduce all of these ideas of gaining something from someone else. The most vulnerable always are at risk. So I feel like a lot of people who are trying to do work, like humanitarian, migrant aid, help, they have this idea of like, we're going to do it through the church. But at the end of the day, they're exploiting this image of the immigrant. So for me, it's just the idea that we have to check ourselves all the time and see if we're working ethically, because if you're a believer, right, he wouldn't do the same.
So many great thoughts. So first, just to end it off, I am a believer as well. Grew up deeply entrenched in the church. So I definitely believe that God has ordained me to be on this path of working with the most marginalized groups, to be at the forefront, to be empowered, to tell their own stories, to understand that they're intellectuals in their own right, and spreading this idea of equity and love and co-collaboration and this communal idea of sharing stakes, right? So if we all have stakes in these issues, whether or not, like June said, your family were peasants, right? I don't know. I'm pretty sure my family probably were peasants too. But let's say they were kings and queens, right? That doesn't mean that my family has any more power or is superior to yours or to yours, Liz, right? The fact that we may have different social locations, may have had different means economically, socially, whatever, we still are all human beings. And so this idea of thinking about each other on a humanistic level, we're all equal in a certain sense, as we all have equal claim to this land, to this earth as people, that idea of shared humanity, I guess is what I'm trying to say, shared humanity is what God was preaching, is what Jesus Christ was preaching when he came down, laid down his life for us and for our sins. And so, yeah, I think this idea that we all have, we have to see how if one of us is suffering, we're all suffering in the end, right? So whereas I believe that as a humanist, right, as someone who's in the humanities, in the arts, someone who wants to ensure that we all do see that we are all interconnected, just like Christ taught, that's ideal. It'll take many, many years to get there, but that is my hope as a believer and as a practitioner, a historian, and as a storyteller. So hopefully, my practice and my beliefs will intermarry in a way that, that honors all people, regardless of faith, regardless of beliefs or backgrounds, but that does honor all of us as humans on this planet and this journey of life together.